So this, let's just check for fun that this isn't zero. Just something along the line. I mean, you have to check, of course, a lot more. You just, but I mean, you have to just plug this into that equation and verify that it works. And use the fact that A, B, and C come from this. I'm not going to show you that. It's just tedious algebra, but very elementary. But let's just check, for example, that this is not zero. Well, n is, by definition, a half AB. So this is 2, 1 half AB squared A plus C. I'm not really sure doing this is worth the time. Maybe I'll skip that. So that's one direction. And the other direction, which is a little bit more interesting, so given a pair of x, y, you get a right triangle, the side lengths of a right triangle, namely, and here's the formula, n squared minus x squared over y minus 2xn over y, and you can see why the y better be non-zero, and n squared plus x squared over y. Okay, so that allows you to go back and forth between solutions to this equation and right triangles with area n. In particular, you now have, just to really emphasize this, proposition 6.58 says you could decide whether or not an integer n is a congruent number just by checking whether or not there are infinitely many points, really any points besides the two torsion, on the curve E sub n. The problem, of course, is that in general, we don't know for sure that we can check whether or not there are points on there. So here's an example. Example 6.59. You take n equals 5, and the curve is y squared equals x cubed minus 25x. And if you just stare at that one, you might notice that minus 4 minus 6 is a solution. So this is for n equals 5. You look at the curve y squared equals x cubed minus 25x. So if you just look at the number 5 and try to find a right triangle with that area, well, the first right triangle, you thought of 2, 3, 4, that didn't work. That gave you area 6, so you might think you've missed it, and there isn't a chance. Remember, the side lengths are rational numbers, so it could be some complicated way of getting 5. So it's kind of hard just to eyeball this and figure out whether or not 5 is the area of a right triangle. But this equation, you might see pretty quickly that minus 4 minus 6 is a solution. So x, y equals minus 4 minus 6 solves this. Let's just check that. On the right you have, I guess, minus 64. I think I did that right. And minus 25 times minus 4. So it's 100 minus 64. Is 36, and indeed that's the square of minus 6. So you can eyeball this solution maybe a little more easily than you could the thing over here. And all you have to do is use this formula right here, and you get the side lengths of your right triangle. So let's do it. This maps to, using the math over there, which in the midst is to g. This solution, minus 4, minus 6, that maps to the g, to the triple. So n squared minus x squared, 25 minus x squared, x is minus 4, so that's 25 minus 16 over y. Y is minus 6, comma minus 2xn. So minus 2 minus 4 minus 5, again, divided by y, minus 6. And then finally, n squared plus s squared over minus 6. So 25 plus 16 over minus 6. So what is that? So 25 minus 16, that's 9 over minus 6, which is minus 3 halves. And then the next one is minus 2 times minus 4, so 40 over minus 6, so 20 over minus 23rds, and then the last one is 41 over minus 6, which is minus 41 over 6. Okay, good. That matches with my notes. And these three numbers, they satisfy the two equations here, or at least they should. And we can just get rid of the minus signs. So I multiply 3 by minus 1, which changes the area by minus 1 squared, which is okay. So now let's check and see if this really works. So do you really get 5 as the area? And are these really the sides of a right triangle? So it's kind of getting a little tedious to do by hand. So we have three numbers there, and we need to check that two things. So first, the area is pretty easy. That's 3 halves times 20 thirds times 1 half. So that's 5. Everything cancels and you get 5. Excellent. Okay, then the next thing is, this one's slightly harder. So 3 over 2 squared plus 20 over 3 squared. Let's see if we get the same thing as 41 over 6 squared. And it's a miracle we do, in fact, get that. So these are the side lengths of a right triangle. And somehow it was easier, I think, to find this point than to find somehow these side lengths. We didn't know anything. But now, the really neat thing is we could take this point, add it to itself a few times, and get a really complicated triangle. So I've written some code, which I've handed out to you. And it allows you to compute explicitly in each direction this bijection. It also has some other functions. They're all illustrated for a very complicated number 101 at the top of the page. So here's how it works. So there's actually some more theory I'll have to tell you about in a minute. So let's just look at this one particular example. So let E be the congruent curve. Let's see, what is the function called? Number curve associated to the number 5. Okay, so that's our curve. Y squared equals x cubed minus 25x. It's defined over the rational numbers. And now let E be generators for the Mordell Weil group. Okay, and it found minus 4 plus 6, which is just as good. And let's let P be that generator. Okay. And now there's a function here called congruent triangle. It's defined at the bottom of page 3, and it goes from a point on a curve here to a triangle, to the side lengths of a triangle. So say congruent triangle P. And we get back this triangle. But what if we take 2 times P? You get that complicated looking point, and you can do the same thing, and you get back this amazing triangle. So if I say A, B, and C are equal to the output of the line 12, so A, B, and C, let's check it. A squared plus B squared, let's see if that's C squared. It's true. And let's see if A times B over 2 has area 5. So amazing. These three give you the side lengths of a right triangle with area 5. And you can get a lot of others that are very, very complicated. Like 5 times P. See? So somehow you understand more about this question than you might have understood before. Also, you
If you understand a little more about the arithmetic of elliptic curves, you'll see that this, the fact that this point P is not a torsion point, that's giving you again that there are infinitely many solutions, which is something that would be hard to see directly from the definitions. All right, so now the
crux of the whole problem is this. Well, there are two things. One is easily deciding whether or not either N has a positive ring. Or equivalently, if you assume the BST conjecture, you'd like to be able to, in a fairly elementary way, decide whether or not this is equal to zero. It's in fact possible always to decide whether or not that equals to zero. But the general algorithm that works for any elliptic curve at all is extraordinarily slow. It's basically polynomial time in the conductor of the curve. That's really, really bad. So these curves have conductor, I think, probably 27 times n squared.
The conductor is just this integer that somehow measures the complexity of the curve, but if we look at, see what it is, what is it for our curve? I think our curve is called E. Its conductor it's 32 times n squared.
So for these curves, the conductor is 32 times n squared. And there is a method, polynomial time, in the conductor that allows you to decide this, but it's pretty bad. I mean, the conductor's already this big, so if n were 2005, already the conductor's quite large. It's 32 times 2005 squared, so that's, you know, well over a billion. And this algorithm is actually polynomial time in that, so it's more like the amount of actual time it takes is something like the cube of that, so it's just completely impractical even for that. Well, actually, for that size, you can do it, but for my, well, no, actually, probably not. Using the general algorithm for deciding this, it would not work. But in this particular case, there's a much better method that relies on modular forms. There is a very, very bizarre the first time you heard it, but there's a modular form. And its coefficients are up to a non-zero multiple. The nth coefficient of the modular form is this value. So what you do is you compute the coefficients of the modular form. It's a formal power series. You find the coefficients of it, and the nth coefficient, whether or not it's zero, tells you whether or not this thing is equal to zero. So it's pretty amazing. And you might think, okay, well, let me write that down. That's a very strange thing to just say and not even call it right down. So this is a theorem of Walsh-Fréchet. Actually, I saw this guy give a talk in Paris once, and I didn't understand anything in the talk, but right in the middle of a whole bunch of complicated equations, it said the following. So apparently he was talking about some sort of moduli space that was denoted this way. I found it very amusing. I'll erase that. So, but he's a very amazing mathematician. So anyways, here's his theorem. This is stated very vaguely. But there is a modular form. I'll just call it F. I'll call it H. H of Q equals sum A n Q to the n, such that H of n equals zero if and only if L E n 1 equals zero. So if you believe the Bertrand-Sorrentine-Dyer conjecture, then that you might be a little more hopeful that you can compute explicitly this modular form instead of trying to decide whether or not this is zero directly, and that somehow this might be quicker. And in fact, tunnel, he gave a simple way to compute A sub n directly. So completely elementary. Way to decide whether or not a sub n is equal to 0.
And the elementary way is given as it's part of conjecture 6, 5, 12. So the elementary way is the following. You have in conjecture 6, 5, 12 in the middle of page 121, there are a bunch of sets whose cardinalities are asserted to be equal or not. So if you have an integer n and it's even and square free, then what Tunnel showed was that a sub n is 0, i.e. L of E n 1 is equal to 0, i.e. conjecturally, according to BSD, e sub n has positive rank. If and only if there are two sets given there, the set of triples of integers a, b, c, with 4a squared plus b squared plus 8c squared equal to n over 2, and c even, if and only if that, the cardinality of that set of triples is equal to the cardinality of the other set of triples with, it's the same exact set except that, I mean, it's the same condition except that instead of considering the c with the triples with c even, you consider the triples with c odd. So you can think of it this way. You take all triples of integers a, b, and c so that 4a squared plus b squared plus 8c squared is n over 2. And then if the number with c even is the same as the number with c odd, that means this is 0. And that's a theorem. And that should imply that this is positive ring, hence that n is a congruent number. On the other hand, if the number of triples with c even is not the same as the number with c odd, then this is non-zero, hence this is non-zero, hence this isn't true, and this is not equal to 0, so this has rank 0. Actually, that's that direction, well, that implication is a theorem, because of the way it works. So, in the case when the cardinality of the two sets are different, then you definitely have it LEn1 is not equal to 0. And it's a theorem that when the order of vanishing of the L function at 1 is less than or equal to 1, then the rank equals the order of vanishing. That's the situation under which the BSD conjecture is known. So in that case, you really do know this. So if ever you test this conjecture, you try to use this conjecture, and it says that n should not be a congruent number, then you know that it really isn't. The part of the conjecture we don't know is the other one. Say it says that n should be a congruent number. You don't have, it's complicated. You have to somehow maybe explicitly construct that number, and we don't know how to do that in general. So in the notes, the program that I handed out on page 1, continuing on to page 2, there's a little program for computing those two sets in the case of n even or n odd. And I'll do it for a few examples. So the function's called congruent number sets. It takes as input a positive integer n, and it returns the two sets that appear in the conjecture. When the sets have the same cardinality, you know that an is 0, i.e., you know that this function len is 1. When the sets have different cardinality, you know that it doesn't. And this function computes the two sets. For example, for 6, the set should have the same cardinality, because 6 is obviously a congruent number. And in fact, the two sets, they're both empty, and they have the same cardinality. Let's try to show that they're empty. We're looking for triples of integers, so that 4a squared plus b squared plus 8c squared is 3. So the claim is that there aren't any. Does anybody have any idea how to show that? 4a squared plus b squared plus 8c squared equals n over 2. And we're taking n to be 6 for the moment, so that's 3. These are a, b, and c in the integers. So why does that have no solutions at all?
A and c both have to be 0.
That's right. If a or c were bigger than 0, then this number would be, if c were bigger than 0, this would be at least 8. If a were bigger than 0, this would be at least 4. So they're both 0. Therefore, you know that b must be square root of 3, which is not an integer. So you're done. So this has no solutions at all. And consequently, 6 has to be a congruent number according to this criterion. Well, this criterion says that it should be. Conjecturally, it is. And assuming the BSD conjecture would have to be. So the conjecture asserts that it should be. It's a simple criterion. So let me just add in here two blocks. Cardinalities of sets.
So you can imagine, I don't know, 50 years ago at least, the connection here being made. And you can imagine people, you know, thinking about this, but there's something very non-elementary about this problem. Whereas if you allow the BSD conjecture, you get to go down here, and then you just have cardinalities of two sets that are defined in a very elementary manner just by considering this equation being equal. And that's supposed to be the case. These cardinalities are equal if and only if n is a common right number. Just to even think to make that conjecture, there's no obvious reason to make a conjecture about cardinalities of two sets being equal, being a criterion for whether or not n is a congruent number, if you don't know about elliptic curves, and you don't know about, you have to know about both elliptic curves and modular forms, and L functions attached to elliptic curves. You have to know about all of these things, but once you know about all of them, you could state this conjecture, the cardinalities of these very elementarily defined sets are equal if and only if n is a congruent number. You can state that. It has absolutely nothing a priori to do with elliptic curves as stated. Nobody knew that that should be the right conjecture until this extensive theory of elliptic curves was developed. But once that theory was developed, you kind of dive in, you float in the clouds, you understand all these, there's this theorem, et cetera, and there's the Birch-Swinton-Dyer conjecture. You put it all together, and then you get this very elementary sounding conjecture, 6.5.12, which is in fact a theorem in one direction. The direction being, if the cardinalities are not equal, then it's true that n is not a congruent number. So let's try some other examples. Five. So yes, please.
Assuming the BSD conjecture, is this the fastest algorithm for deciding? One of the fastest?
I don't know, actually.
I'm not sure. This is definitely the way you'd want to go. But the question is the simple criterion involving counting the cardinalities of these sets, is that the best way to decide whether or not an equals zero? That's not clear.
Okay.
And you could also, if n were large, you could possibly get lucky and be able to show that this is say not zero via some other method, and that would be better than this. So it kind of depends on n, but it's pretty good. In the implementation, you don't iterate through all triples, you iterate through possibilities for C, and then for that, possibilities for A, and then you solve for B, for example. So it's still not so good, though. I'll compute the sets for some bigger values. So I'll call the sets S1 and S2. So somebody name a number. Somebody choose a number. What?
Seven.
Seven, okay. Well, not so big. Okay, somebody braver. Sorry.
A million or 100?
Okay, I'll start with 100. It immediately reduces to, that's interesting. So 100 is 25 times 4, so it's a perfect square. So that was really the same as 1. Yeah. So that's not so good. 1 is not a. Notice that this tells us 1 is not a congruent number, which is the question I initially asked you. Here, the two sets have different cardinality for n equal to 1. And that implies that this is not equal to 0. We know enough about the Birch-Swinton-Dyer conjecture to get that en has root 0 in that case. So 1 is not a congruent number.
103.
It is a congruent number. Let's find a triangle, maybe. It can be very hard. The triangles can be very complicated. So congruent number curve for 103. So it's that curve. Now we're going to try to find the generators. This could be very difficult. Might fail. Looks like it succeeded. It found one generator. Wow. There it is. And remember, congruent triangle associated to that generator. So there it is. 103 is a congruent number. And there is explicitly for you the simplest triangle that has area 103. And of course, I can give you as many more as I want. So there's the next simplest triangle. So that's 103. Let's see. How about the current? Oh, go on.
541.
I don't know why you chose that, but 541. So yeah, that should be a congruent number, amazingly. What? So, okay. Here's an amusing thing you can do. We can list all the integers up to say 200 that are for which these two sets are equal. So is a congruent, well, is conjecturally a congruent number. Is congruent number tries to find the points on the elliptic curve. Okay, so that should compute all of them. So it's running this, it's computing both sets, then looking at the cardinalities all the way up to 200. Here's what it got. Those are the numbers it got. Now, if I use the set command, I can get the unique numbers that, the unique residue is mod 8. So, so that's a list of the unique numbers that appear. So is anything missing there? What's missing? 3. 3 is missing. So if you look at every number up to 200, none of the ones that are 3 modulo 8 are congruent numbers, which might suggest to you that you should conjecture that if a number is 3 modulo 8, it's not a congruent number. Now let's look a little bit farther. So go from 200 up to 200 and say 50. And there is one where, which is 3. So you have to in fact go all the way up to 219 to find a number that is a congruent number, that is congruent to 3 modulo 8. So you have to be very careful about looking at the first few cases for something like this. And there are, of course, a lot of numbers that are 3 modulo 8 up to that are not congruent numbers. Now, there's actually something interesting and deep going on here, which will be part of your problem 2 in your homework. So what happens here, as is indicated in the hint in problem 2a in the homework, is that the corresponding elliptic curve, y squared equals x cubed minus 219 squared x, the e sub n, that curve has rank 2. So there are two independent generators for the Mordell Weber. And whenever, don't prove that here, but it's a fact that whenever n is 3 modulo 8, the curve has to have, at least conjecturally, even rank. And most of the time, if you have an even rank curve, it should have rank 0. But occasionally, it might have rank 2. So there are a lot of cases with n 3 modulo 8 where the rank is even and it happens to be 0. And 219 is the first case where n is 3 modulo 8, but that rank, which was 0, it's even each time, except there it finally gets over its it being even, and you have rank 2. So you actually have two different points. You have kind of a two-parameter family of right triangles with area 219. And problem two in the homework is about systematically enumerating all of these. So that's another sort of funny thing in the table. We can look at the current year. That's another congruent number. Seem to be a lot of congruent numbers here. At least it's conjecturally a congruent number. But we can go through the whole business again, make the congruent curve for this year, and then try to find generators. I'll set verbose equal to true so you can see all kinds of exciting things happen. So it's running MW rank. It was unable to provably compute the rank, but I just changed Sage slightly so it still gives you what it found. And it found that point on the curve. That's good enough for us. That's a point on the curve. And we can use that point then to write the current year as the area of a right triangle. So, So there you are. A, B, and C, those are the side lengths of a right triangle whose area is 2005. And recall that 2005 is 5 times 4, 1. And of course, you can wonder about next year. So next year is here. I should do the is conjecturally a congruent number. Whoa, next year will be congruent as well. So again, you can do the same thing. So you get the curve, and then you try to find generators. And then it works really hard. And again, it wasn't able to provably find them, but it did find one, fortunately. And so again, so for next year, those are the side lengths of a right triangle whose area is 2006. And then just on a roll here, so what about 2007, 2008, 2009? Let's start thinking, 2010. So that'll be the first year in which the year will not be a congruent So you have a right triangle.
Does anyone know, like, what's the chance? Is it you just pick a number, is it going to be concrete?
That's a very good question.
Like, asking about it. Seems like there's a lot of them just from what you're
doing. Yeah.
I think it should be, I mean, for square free integers, I think it should be about 50-50. Although, what I'm showing you doesn't at all suggest that. But, see, the thing is, what you're doing is you're looking at the whether or not the rank of the twist of this curve, the quadratic twist of this curve by n, is positive or not. So, there's a general question about taking an elliptic curve and looking at the twist of the elliptic curve, the quadratic twist of the elliptic curve, and some proportion of them have rank 0, and some proportion of them have rank 1, and some proportion have rank 2, and rank 3, and so on. And for this particular curve, well, the general conjecture, I think, due to Goldfeld, is that 50% of curves have rank 0, 50% of curves have rank 1 in a family of twists. And this generally seems to be believed. It hasn't been proved in any case at all, but seems to be believed, at least. And there are heuristics that suggest it. So we can do our own little experiment, though. Okay, so let's just do this. Now, this is a little bit bad because I'm not excluding the... I should take only square-free integers, and here I just took all the integers. But let's just see what proportion of the integers up to 300 are congruent numbers. So, 163. That is, in fact, about 50%. So, about half of them are congruent numbers. A little bit more, but not much more. Nonetheless, you have to wait a while for the next year. That will be a congruent number. Okay, so let's see. Is there anything else? All right, questions, please.
Do you think the conjecture is then is you take the limit that it's exactly 1/2?
Yeah. That's the conjecture of Goldfeld. It's a minimalist principle, but there's a reason that half of them should have odd rank, and odd means at least one. So half of them should have odd rank, half of them should have even rank. There's very little dispute about that. So given that half of them have odd rank, half of them have even rank, the minimalist principle would be that the rank on average should, well, most of them should have rank 0. Half of them should have rank 0 and half of them should have rank 1. So the average rank should be a half. That would mean that half of them, there shouldn't really be anything of rank 2 or greater asymptotically. We don't know whether or not this is right, but that's the general conjecture that people seem to make. So, if you just looked at the problem as I initially stated it, you wouldn't really have any sort of framework in which to even answer that question. But at least now I can tell you that standard conjecture about elliptic curves is that half of them should be, half of them shouldn't be. So, by knowing about elliptic curves, you get more insight. Okay, so basically we're done with elliptic curves now, and now we're going to segue into modular forms. So, I'll start on Wednesday talking about modular forms in much more detail than I have before. By the way, there's a book by Neil Koblitz called Introduction to Elliptic Curves and Modular Forms, and this book is all about the congruent number problem. Essentially, the entire book is devoted to proving what I've listed here on the right-hand side of the board. So, explaining this diagram. So, if you want to really deeply understand this diagram, get Springer Graduate Text in Math number 97. This is what I'm going to do some variant of this starting next time, of the last chapter of this book. Or at least of some of the beginning of the last chapter. So, study the Greek SL2.
Yeah, I really like that, how he, he's very clear.
Yeah.
I really like his choice of what to brush over and leaf to exercises and what to think about.
He has a lot of exercises.
So sorry, I wasn't able to turn this in Wednesday.
Okay, this is for last week.
Yeah.
So decimal. Okay. I don't think that's a mistake. Okay, obviously, this is fine. Just kidding.
Did I do that wrong then?
No, this is okay. It's just the.
Oh.
I'm just joking because today I am.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just going to grade it right now.
I forgot one little thing about why that cube cap was objective.
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody did that problem for some strange reason.
I did 2 years ago.
In my class.
And then, I was searching through my books that I actually was able to finally find it.
So it seems like you did do it. You did the problem.
Well, but I thought I...
Did you do it after, when I explained it in class, or did you do it before? Do you know what
to do? No, this isn't.
No, but over here.
I assume I would feel
it's almost right.
Digested.
Okay, well, I'll take off a point. That looks right, so you just scaled. Yep, okay. Let me put it in the records. Hello.
How was Seattle?
It was fun. I gave a talk. My computer wouldn't work with the projector there, which was kind of annoying, so I had to give a Blackboard talk on the fly.
Oh no.
Yeah, that was kind of troublesome. But it went pretty well, actually. And the chair tried really hard to convince me to get it to take a job there or something. They're trying to recruit me there. But I told them I'll think about it.
Yeah.
He's like, we didn't know that your wife was here, and if we'd known that, we would have realized we had a really good chance to hire you, so let's fix that mistake. I interviewed there last year, but I don't think I will do it, but I don't know.
But it was nice. Sage from the website, is that where
you're going to go? No, you log in, so you have two ways to access Sage. One is via the website, which is very simple. You just paste stuff in and run it. The other is you log into the computer using SSH from, for example, Cygwin, or possibly from another SSH client under Windows.
Okay, so if I was logging in on under SSH.
Mm-hmm.
So where's it being on the computer?
Are they Windows or Linux?
What? Does or does not? Yeah.
Okay, good.
So what do I log in as?
Whatever login name you chose,
so
and whatever
name.
Password I gave you on your homework assignment.
But would I log into Modular or I log into
modular.ucsd.edu.
Okay, so that's server.
Yes, that's the server. And it's a very powerful machine in general, with Magma on it as well.
Got it.
Okay, so... Good. Complete log.